Anjanon and Varehu. One of Cryon's favorite subjects has to do with the trials of women in our culture and what the lessons mean personally for them. Cryon is not a he or a she any more than God is. Cryon's entity is that of a master of human understanding who is giving us love information regarding the New Age. As a male, I was uncomfortable at first about translating Cryon's words, which often seem so personally directed toward women. Now, I not only feel comfortable, but understand the joke. We all get our turn, and chances are that all the men reading this will relate at some level, since our lineage of lifetimes would naturally encompass many female incarnations as well. In the translations of these stories, I also got to feel, in whatever capacity I could, what it was like to have some of the problems that only a female could experience in our society. This has tempered me and made me a wiser man. This story is told from the perspective of two angel guides, something that Cryon has done before. Their guide names were given as Anjanon and Varehu. They are the guides of a woman named Wo. As you read this book, you will discover that Wo is in two other parables. Is it the same Wo, you might ask? Indeed it is. But as told here, Wo is in another life.
Anjanon and Varehu were guides. Anjanon was different, for he had been a human before, so he carried the stripe of the human. Varehu had never been human and had always been of the angel guide group. Both of them had been with humans lifetime after lifetime, and both Anjanon and Varehu were excited. They were on their way to another planning session that marked the beginning of yet another human life, always a festive time. They were going to meet their assigned entity shortly. One of those who would be sent to the Earth plane as the Guardian of Love, a human scheduled to be a Warrior of Light. These two guides, Anjanon and Varehu, standing side by side going into the planning session, were going to meet the entity we call Wo. We heard of Wo before in a previous parable given 1 year ago in this very room. Wo stands now in the Chamber of Planning, close to the portal leading to the Cave of Creation. Wo is ready to pick up his essence and return with his karma intact to the planet Earth. Anjanon and Varehu are part of the planning, and here it is that Wo and all the others plan the lessons generated by the karma, past lives, and the current experiences they will have. The planning is clear, but is not to be confused with predestination. Again, Wo will come into the Earth plane, where he will be exposed to the appropriate karma, and he will have his chance to walk through it, just as he had in the past. This is done to give Wo a chance to raise the vibration of the planet through his efforts. So Wo is prepared, in this planning session, to pick up where he left off, karma-wise, and return to Earth. Here, Wo plans with other entities yet to come into lesson, and with the higher souls of those already on Earth walking in lesson. So it was that the formerly male Wo decided to come back with Anjanon and Varehu, this time as a Wo man, or woman. The guides willingly began their journey to come to Earth with her, and so it was also that she chose the attributes to be born on the first day of the month of September. She is going to have a difficult time with control. In the first years of life, Wo is abused by her father, abused by her stepfather, and even abused by her stepfather's brother. By the time she is 11 years old, she carries the heavy karma of a long cycle by design. During this time, Anjanon and Varehu stand beside her, watching her pre-planned karma of choice develop. Dear ones, there is no such thing as predestination. Your lessons are decided and set in advance, but the solutions are yours while you are on the Earth. It is thus, if you were to send entities down to Earth as hammers and visit them some years later, you would not be surprised to find them in the company of nails. This is logic, not predestination. So the attributes of the ones who are born September 1st are known, and you will not be surprised at the problems they encounter or the lessons that they must walk through. Wo has a difficult time with males. She has no problems with abundance, for this is not the karma she carries. Money seems to come easily to her, and in the area of earth business, she delights in her quest to rise to the top. She becomes spiteful due to the anger and energy of her karmic lesson, and she devours the spirit of males around her, enjoying the game of business and of winning over her male counterparts. She tried partnerships 3 times, but none were able to survive due to her anger. As Woe grew older, her health became poorer, and her imbalance allowed for stress-related disease. Anjanon and Varehu watched in love, quietly knowing that all was appropriately set for the next stage. For Woe and the others had decided that this could be a very important incarnation, one to remember due to the Earth's new attributes. It was in Woe's 47th year that she was accidentally exposed to an enlightened woman. In one of those business intensives where humans are forced together for a week, unable to escape in the name of efficiency, Anjanon and Varehu both recognized the woman, for it was an entity from the same planning session that they had attended 47 years earlier. This was the one who was scheduled to appear this year, and if Woe was ready, to inform her of God's gifts in the new age. As fate would have it, Woe was interested in this woman. Woe wanted to know what was different about her. And as if by fate, cosmic joke, Woe approached the woman late one night and asked the question, "Why is it you have peace? How are you so tolerant of men? What's your secret?" Anjanon and Varehu were on their toes. Poised in the balance of the moment was everything they had waited for. They both sensed the potency of what was happening, and they knew that this was the prime window of opportunity that they had been preparing for. Never in the history of their guide assignments had anything like this happened. As the woman spoke of truth, Woe remained stoic, taking it all in. Later that night, it happened. Alone in her room, she openly wept, raised her hands in apparent desperation, and verbally asked if God would grant her an audience. As if the light were suddenly turned on, Anjanon and Varehu were put into action. She had expressed intent. Yes, the universe was listening. Yes, there was something else grander than the human intellect, and yes, she could have peace during her incarnation. Anjanon and Varehu celebrated, and it caused Woe a very sleepless night to have all that activity around her bed. Things started changing quickly for Woe. She met with the woman many more times and became fast friends with her. She met others who took her through processes and gave her information she needed. All the time, Anjanon and Varehu were rejoicing in the new communication they were allowed to have with Woe and her higher God self. Later, a third angel guide from a master group joined Anjanon and Varehu, and so it was that Woe was able to walk directly into her karma and forgive those who had harmed her soul. And so it was that she gained wisdom and realized her responsibility for all that had happened. And with her wisdom came love, and with the love came action. Then came a time when Woe not only was able to tolerate the males in her life, but actually partner with one, successfully and lovingly. This was quite amazing, considering who Woe used to be. In Woe's 53rd year, Anjanon and Varehu were required to leave. Woe had become of such a vibration that a totally new set of guides were needed to best serve her. As her set of guides retreated from her for a period of 90 days, Woe was without support. But even under this stress, Woe understood what was happening and quietly busied herself with other human things, and she got through this period without difficulty. Anjanon and Varehu celebrated again. You might have thought that Woe's angel friends would have been unhappy, that they would have felt sorrow and grief at having to depart from a much-loved friend, one whom they had waited for and planned for so long. But Anjanon and Varehu knew that the parts were in balance, and the graduation of the one exalted the whole. So they willingly departed without rebellion or even a thought of anything but love for the process. We leave Woe there, because her future has not been realized yet. Much like your own.
In this story, Woe is a she, and the entire story is told from the perspective of the guides. This parable contains important information regarding the working of the guides. Remember that in earlier writings, Cryon has told us of the fact that we all come in with at least two guides who are always with us. That some of us get a third, and that with the enlightenment, there is the potential of a full guide change. This full guide change is often a 90-day challenge that he has spoken of before. Right away, Cryon lets us know about the two guides who are going to be assigned to Woe. One guide has been a human before, and one has not. This information would indicate that humans don't always come back as humans. Did you ever wonder if your guardian angel was someone you used to know? This story provides evidence that it could actually be that way. The information is that the angel guides are specialists in service to support us in lesson, and that the guide group contains those who were always guides and others who were humans. The next bit of information is that the guides are with us when the contracts are planned. Cryon has told us from the start that we are part of the God energy, that we, while in God consciousness, something that humans can't understand fully, plan our own incarnations and the opportunities for lessons within them. This, by the way, makes us totally responsible for absolutely everything that happens to us along the way, since we have been told through countless messages that there are no accidents and that coincidence isn't. So the guides are going to the planning meeting to meet the human that they will accompany and to actually plan the opportunities for the next life. This is wonderful information, and it helps us to understand why the guides are important, for they stand by to implement plans that we all helped make. Cryon also wants us to once again recognize the difference between what is going on in this planning session in regard to predestination. Predestination is a human concept and is not a spiritual reality. Our planning sessions are only setups for lesson. In other words, when you are in school at your desk, you can do anything you want with a test in front of you. Throw it away, make a paper airplane and fly it out the window, or muster up some energy and pass it. It's totally up to you. In this case, the test was written by you when you were in God consciousness, but you don't recognize this fact at all. Can you see how this differs greatly from predestination? We have total free choice all the time. Cryon's humor again shows itself with his analogy of hammers and nails surrounding his explanation of how the planning works. The next piece of startling information is that the planning session includes the higher souls of those already on Earth walking in lesson. Take a look at this. It's the first indication from Cryon that karmic planning involves those already living and walking around. This is how the engine of group karma is therefore facilitated. In other words, if the karmic planning committee always had to wait for humans to pass on before the next incarnations were planned, it would be very inefficient. Entities would be literally standing around, waiting for the others to die before they could plan how to interact with them the next time. Think about it. You interact karmically with parents and children. Therefore, there are big age differences. So this explains how it can be that a child could come into the world and die, sadly but appropriately, for the lesson of the parents, and then come in again shortly thereafter as still another child of the same parents, if appropriate. I say this not to indicate that God has this scenario happen, but to show how the planning works. How can the planning involve the living, you might ask? Cryon has told us on many occasions of the oversoul or higher self of each of us. In fact, the quest of your enlightenment and ascension is to marry to your higher self and stick around the planet as a power worker. Evidently, this higher self is part of us, in contact with God all the time, but whose energy is not totally in our bodies. Therefore, there is still communication with God on karmic things, at least. This also helps explain how the complex interaction of karma can continue to change as those around us work through their karma and we work through ours. In other words, we alter the lesson plan as we pass each test. Part of us is keeping score. The story sets up Wo as an abused child who is harmed by many men who are supposed to be part of her family support group. This is given to help you see how the abandonment karma is set up and what kind of personality type might result. Evidently, Wo becomes an overachieving woman with no financial problems, but one who has a lot of trouble with men. No wonder. She likes to win at business, and she enjoys competition with men. The actual translation was that she likes to beat them at their own game. She has 3 failed marriages or relationships of some kind, and she carries around a great deal of anger, which later gives her stress-related health problems. Now, where were Anjanon and Varehu all this time? What good is all this guardian angel stuff if they don't do anything to help somebody in this type of mess? Well, these questions are joke questions, since the reality is that Anjanon and Varehu watched in love, quietly knowing that all was appropriately set up for the next stage. All 47 years of this woman's life were a setup to a great test that was coming. Think of it, the patience of the angels. The scheduled one, as Kryon called her, arrived on the scene. The guides recognized her instantly and got excited. Reading on, this scheduled person who came into Wo's life was actually part of the contract planning session 47 years earlier. Think of the complexity of this. In her own way, Wo recognized the woman too, because it says that Wo was interested in her and the things she had to say. Here was a woman who was different. The tar wasn't sticking to her. This is a reference to the first parable on this tape, the parable of the tar pit. Look how these parables intertwine with the same information. Here is an enlightened woman who comes into Wo's life and causes Wo to change, and all she has to do is be there. So it goes that Wo just had to know about this unnamed woman's peace and inner joy, and her tolerance toward men. Remember that Wo was now in a state of imbalance and was ill. This was the state necessary for her to surrender enough of her ego to ask another woman about these intangible things. Notice, too, how the parable used one woman to be the messenger for this other woman, even though we are all human and our gender isn't supposed to make a difference to God. It does when karma is concerned, though, for much of the karma we carry is the energy generated around the opposite sex, father and mother issues, and so on. Lately, science has also discovered that our brains are biologically connected in different ways, and it is finally acknowledged that we actually think differently. No kidding. I wonder how much money they spent on that. I could have verified it for nothing had they asked. The woman shared her spiritual truth with Wo. The guides were poised and ready for this event. Here was the test they had experienced and waited for. The parable tells us that Wo asked for help alone in her room, and by verbalizing her intent, she started the amazing process that followed. The story goes on to tell of the change in Wo's life and of the third guide that joined Anjanon and Varejo down the line. This guide was from a master angel guide group. Again, Kryon speaks of the master guides as being different from the normal ones. To some, this is the same as receiving a higher kind of angel in their lives. All this nomenclature is appropriate, since my translation of Kryon uses only my words. I believe that one could use the words guides or angels interchangeably if desired, and that it really isn't important what you call them as long as you understand the incredible mechanics of why they are here and the love they carry for us. So Wo ended up being an enlightened human, forgiving those in her past, recognizing that she was responsible for everything, and finally having real peace. At that point, she was able finally to partner with a man and make it work. The real test. Look at what happens next in the parable. Our heroes Anjanon and Varehu are replaced. What kind of story is this, anyway, where the good guys get knocked out in the middle? This would never work in the movies. How do you think Anjanon and Varehu felt? Weren't they good enough to stay with Wo from here on? After all, they had endured 47 years of anger and frustration. Hadn't they earned a chance to enjoy the results of the planning that they had helped with? Wo had given intent for enlightenment and was moving toward a status that demanded master guides, and Anjanon and Varehu knew it and were ecstatic with joy. They departed with much love and no sadness. They had been part of earth history and celebrated all of it. Such is the mind of God that one entity can celebrate the joy of the other so completely. Once you truly see the big picture, you can celebrate your neighbor's good fortune and mean it, even if you are feeling that your life isn't going as well as his or hers. Some folks never understand how this can be. Putting on the mantle of the Spirit of God is what Cryon often invites us to do. This means to carry with us the connection to the higher self and move into such balance that our first feelings toward all humans are love-based, without any of the other baggage that used to be dragged in. Honor the one next to you, for his or her process is related to yours, even if you feel it is vastly different. David the Indian. Here is a story about an Indian who lived on a lovely island with everything he needed. But his curiosity to know more about his surroundings separated him from the rest.
There was an Indian named David who lived on an island. And for those of you who wish to know more about why an Indian was named David, you'll have to analyze that later. This island that David lived on was a good one and was abundant. David was of the lineage of royalty on the island, for his grandfather was the chief. David lived a fine life on the island. There was an abundance of food, and much grew and could be eaten. David's village and his tribe lived well for many, many years. Now, the island was surrounded by an odd attribute, for there was a great fog bank that was very thick encasing it, starting 3 miles from the shore. It surrounded the island completely, and since the fog never came onto the shore, the days on the island were generally sunny and clear. The fog remained offshore at the same distance from year to year like an ominous sign, and no one could ever see beyond it. David grew up with this fog, and those in the village had experienced it generation after generation. They did not understand it, but they feared it, since every so often there would be a villager who would journey into the fog bank and never return. Even as a boy, David can remember one of the older tribesmen who was near death, who chose to get into his canoe and go into the fog. There were many stories about what would happen if you went into the fog, mostly told at night by the light of the campfires. The villagers were taught that if anyone ever went into the fog, the rest of the villagers were to go into their houses and their villages and not watch. You see, there was a great fear around this evil fog. But David, being royalty, got to watch these few events with the elders as a child and later as a teenage boy. But the only event he really remembered was the time the old one went into the fog. He remembered that as the old man went into the fog bank, he saw him pick up his paddle as his canoe slid gently into the fog. And, as expected, he never came out again, just as the elders had said, no one who ventures into the bank ever returns. And those of royal lineage stayed for many hours watching the fog after the old one had disappeared into it, waiting for something that was foretold to happen. For often, after a time, they would hear a giant, muffled noise, a fearful sound that would strike fear into their hearts, a roaring that they could not understand. David would remember what it sounded like for the rest of his life. Who knows what it could have been? Perhaps a monster on the other side of the fog bank. Perhaps the sound of a giant whirlpool or waterfall, just waiting to claim the lives of those who would go through it. Now, it seems odd that David, in his 34th year, would have made the decision he did, but he felt a pull to the fog. He felt that there was something more to his life that he was missing. Perhaps it was a truth that had been lying dormant for years, and somehow the fog had the answer. It is true no one had ever come back, but that didn't mean that they were gone, thought David. So David set out with courage, without telling any of the elders or villagers, to see what was on the other side of the fog bank. He got into his canoe slowly and gave ceremony in preparation for what he was about to do. He thanked God for his life and for the revelation of what was to come. He knew that no matter what happened to him, at least he would have knowledge. And that was what drove him on. And so David paddled silently and gently toward the fog bank. No one was watching, for he did not announce what was taking place. Soon he was on the brink of the fog, and it was coming even nearer. Then David noticed a strange thing. No one had ever purposely gotten close enough to the bank before to observe anything like this, but it was pulling him into it. The element of fear at this surprise started to grip him. David did not need his paddle any longer, and so he picked it up and put it into the canoe. The canoe disappeared into the fog with him in it. It was still and quiet while David was in the fog bank, as the current kept pulling him forward. It became darker and darker, and then David began to reconsider what he had done. "I am a young man. I have failed my elders, for I was in the royal lineage, and I have chosen a foolish, foolish thing." David was now afraid, and the fear came over him like a blanket of death, and the blackness started creeping into his brain, and he shook with coldness and emotion as the canoe sped silently along by itself. David was in the fog bank for hours, and it seemed like it would never end. He cowered in his canoe, for he knew that he had made a mistake. "What if nothing ever changes?" he said to himself. "What if I am here for all eternity and starve in this canoe?" David suddenly had a vision of fear where all those who went before him were now floating endlessly in their canoes, going in circles around the island as skeletons in the dark fog. Would he see that old one from years ago? Would anything ever change? "Oh, where is the truth that I sought?" cried David out loud in the fog. Then it happened. David came out of the other side of the fog bank. He was astounded at what he saw, for there in front of him was an entire continent, clear, filled with many villagers and villages as far as he could see. He could see smoke coming from their smokestacks and hear them playing on the beaches. There were lookouts stationed along the fog bank who saw him immediately, and as he came through, they observed him and sounded their horns in celebration to let the others know on the shore that another brave one had come through the fog. Then David heard a giant roar come forth from the land, a roar of celebration, a roar of honor. They surrounded him with canoes and threw flowers. When he got to the beach, they came and they took him and they put him on their shoulders and celebrated his coming through the fog. David, the royal one, began a new, enriched life that day.
Now you might say, "I know what this parable is about. It's about death, isn't it?" No, it's not. This parable is about coming into the new energy and even about ascension. It's also about being content within your small group and never venturing out of it due to the fog of unfamiliarity. It is about what is before you if you wish to walk the path. For in front of each of you is a fog bank, which sometimes is your fear and other times is your unchanging nature. Each kind of fog is a different challenge and lesson for each person in varying degrees. What is it that gives you the most fear? For many of you, it is the fear of succeeding and the fear of being on your contracted path, the fear of abundance. Perhaps it is the fear of enlightenment itself. Maybe it's the fear of change. We encourage you to walk into this fear standing tall. Whatever it is that gives you the most anxiety, that you know is your life's lesson, must be walked into, face first, with courage, knowing that it is simply a facade. The fear is the fog bank in the parable, and on the other side is celebration. But moving into it sometimes creates a time of darkness, a transitional time to allow you to adjust to what is coming. Those around you will warn you against it, telling you that it is not for you. But part of you knows the truth, and some of you will seek it out for yourselves. Why does Cryon bring you such a parable? It is to exemplify responsibility in this new age of ours. Now is the time of enablement, of responsibility for the entire energy of the planet. And it is time for you to recognize your path. It's time to look into the eyes of your adversaries and say, "I know you. I know who you are, and I choose to disengage from your energy." This is where the tests are passed, and where the vibrations are raised for the planet. For there is no sweeter spot on this planet than for you to recognize who you are. For all of the things that give you grief can now be changed by your intent to make it so.
Aaron and the Globe of Essence. Here is a short story given by Kryon before an audience in Sedona, Arizona, about a man's search for youth, healing, and wisdom. Money was no object as he traveled the world looking for his elusive dream.
Dear ones, Kryon gives you these parables and these stories on purpose, for they are metaphoric and usually do not always represent an actual person on earth. These parables and these stories are given to you in love. Oh, such great love. For they have to do with human self-awareness, and they have to do with healing and long potential lives. Aaron was on the earth as a wealthy man, and when he was in his 40th year, he was disturbed by what he saw in the mirror. What he saw there was a man who was beginning to change and age. He didn't like what his face or his stature were turning into. All around him, he saw his friends catching various diseases, and some of them were even dying. So he said to himself, "What can I do that would change this? Surely there must be an answer. I know I have my wealth for some reason." Now Aaron was a godly man with a great lineage. He thought, "I will use my wealth to discover what some have called the fountain of youth." And so he went to a very wise man and asked him, "Does the fountain of youth exist?" The shaman said to him, "Not exactly, but there is something we know of as the globe of essence. It is real and it is physical. It will extend your life and will heal your diseases. It will also give you great wisdom." "O wise man," Aaron said, "tell me, where can I find this globe of essence?" "Well," replied the wise one of the ways is to find the chalice of Christ." "Oh no," Aaron interrupted, "that is the Holy Grail, and I do not believe in that. My religion does not support these things." The wise man smiled and said, "Aaron, believe it or not, the globe of essence, the chalice of Christ, and the Holy Grail were all carried within the Ark of the Covenant." Aaron thought, "How can this be? The Ark was considerably before Christ." Aaron ignored this last statement from the shaman, pursuing only what he heard that interested him. "Tell me, where should I look to find this globe of essence?" The shaman replied, "It is for you to have, if you choose, for we can see your contract clearly, and we know that you could be the one to find it. All you have to do is begin your search and trust God to lead the way." Aaron was very excited, for he interpreted this to mean that he was the one scheduled to find the globe of essence for the planet. Once it was discovered, Aaron thought, think of those he could help and heal, for he would have a long life as well as those around him, his friends, his relatives. Oh, this was even better than he had thought. He believed the wise man, for there was no reason not to. So Aaron began his search, thinking, "Where shall I go first?" Answering his own question intuitively, he said, "I will go first to those spots on the planet that I know have the highest energy." So he went to Sedona. He searched all around, and he spoke to the guardians of the canyon. The guardian said, "You will not find it in the canyon. You must look in other places." So his trip took him to some of the most sacred places on the planet. "Where is the highest religious place?" Aaron asked himself. Again answering himself, he said, "It is my home. I will go there." So Aaron went to the Holy Land and sat in front of many religious leaders, some of whom had never heard of the Globe of Essence, and some of whom said, "Yes, we have heard and we know. Continue your search. Indeed, you are one who may find it." So Aaron went into the other areas, the areas of Egypt that were close by. He asked the same questions and got much the same result. He went to the land of Peru and to the land of India. He sat in front of some who said they personally were the globe of essence, that all he had to do was to remain with them and give them his attention and his possessions. Aaron knew better, for he knew that it was an object, something that he could touch, and that it was for all humanity and not for just one group. Now this search of Aaron's took him many, many years. He was growing older the entire time, and he was changing. This was frightening him, and so Aaron started to worry. The worry interrupted his body's function, and Aaron became sick. Aaron was on his deathbed, surrounded by those who loved him. He knew he had not found the globe of essence, and those around him did too. He was angry at the wise man who told him he would find it. "What kind of trick is this?" he asked. "What has God done to me?" Aaron was ill and depressed by the fact that the globe of essence had escaped him so completely. His family had watched his quest consume him, and they told him to stop the search for his own sake. He was very tired and longed to sleep. The next morning, he awoke, and this time he stood up. He felt wonderful, but something was different. As his guides came closer to him, he realized that he had indeed passed over. Aaron was not happy at this moment, and he said to his guides as soon as they were before him, "I know who you are, and I know where I'm going. What foolish trick is this that I have not found the promised globe of essence? For I was told by the holy man that I would. Have you all deceived me?" His guide smiled at him, and in perfect love, they embraced him with their energy. They asked him to turn around and look behind him. There, in the place where Aaron had lain, was the globe of essence. There it was. It was physical, and he could touch it. It had weight and substance, and it had been in his heart the whole time. Aaron was dumbfounded at the implications of what he was seeing. He looked around the table at his relatives, and he was shocked. For among those living humans who were sobbing and mourning his passing, in each one was a globe of essence as well. Then Aaron understood that there was not just one globe of essence. It was for all humanity, the wise man had said. "You will find it if you search." But the wise man never said there was only one. And then Aaron knew. He looked at his guides, and he understood. He smiled and said, "Thank you, for now I understand my contract and my lesson." Then he turned and walked between his angel friends toward the light, a place he had been many times before. He was not interested in remaining a moment longer in what seemed to be a low vibrational energy. Even in his short time in the new vibration, Aaron understood that all things learned during his lifetime would be passed on to his next incarnation, and he could hardly wait. For he knew of the trip through the tunnel, through the cave where the record is kept of his incarnations, and then on to the Hall of Honor, and after that, the planning sessions and the return to the planet. For when he returned, he knew that he indeed would be the one to find the globe of essence. He would do it as a child, and he would live a very long life. For he would remember this time. He'd remember the lesson that the globe of essence is the gift of the precious part of God within each human.
This parable is not lost on any of you. Kryon says that there are those of you who sit reading these words by appointment. God gives you the ability to reach out and discover the elusive Holy Grail, for this is the globe of essence, which is God in you. It is the part of God that resides in each of us, which many call the higher self. Here is a story that shouts, "Reach out and take it and be healthy. Live a long time. Be in your sweet spot. God wants you to remain and live very long lives." Some of you are saying, "This cannot be, because I look around and I do not see God residing in the troubled humans around me. Kryon says that when enough of us find our globe of essence, we indeed will look around us and see the changes. But it must start in the room you are in right now, and rooms like this all over the planet. In your quietness, you may search for what you carry from birth, and through your personal discovery you may change the way things work around you, which will have an effect on others, and which can eventually change the area you live in. You carry with you the seeds of the universal Spirit of God, and all of the healing and wisdom that goes with it. God invites you to reach inward and discover the reality of this, and the peace that comes with it. And the planet will change because of what you do in your most quiet time.
Sarah and the Old Shoe. Ready for a real short one? I love this parable because it represents how I think some of the time. I can really relate to becoming comfortable with almost anything. Why change it if things are working? What? You tell me it isn't working? Now that's silly.
Sarah was a New Age enlightened woman. She understood how to take responsibility for her life and that she was to find her reason for being on the planet. Sarah therefore asked her guides how to go about finding her sweet spot, the place where she agreed to be. They gave her good information. She understood the process and set about to co-create what she knew was her passion. Sarah wished to be part of the ecology of the planet, to help with improving the Earth and all who lived on it. So through a window of opportunity that suddenly appeared, a coincidence, she was given the chance to do just that. The opportunity came in the form of a job within a company that worked with high-end ecological systems, something that excited Sarah greatly and made her feel that she could make a difference for many people. Her new job would take her across town each day to work in a comfortable office where she could accomplish her life's goal. "This is why I'm here," she acknowledged. "I have such a passion for this." She was elated and peaceful. Everything was working out fine as she started the job, except for one thing. You see, coming into this incarnation on the planet, Sarah was given a fear of small places. In order to get to her job, it was necessary for Sarah to ride the subway train, and she was paralyzed twice a day by the experience. Each morning, she would enter the subway and would slowly fry in her own fear. She would be anxious, gripping the pole with her sweaty hands, and her heart would pound for the entire 25 minutes it took to travel to this wonderful job. After a month, Sarah came to her guides and painfully admitted, "This is not working for me. I need to find another job." Her guides asked her, "How can this be? Didn't you co-create the exact situation you asked for? Is this not a victory? I can't continue going to the job because of my fear of small places," replied Sarah. "It spoils my entire day two times, coming and going." "Sarah," her guide suggested, "how about if we eliminate the fear, not the job?" "I don't know," replied Sarah hesitantly. "I've had the fear of small places for 35 years. I've only had the job for a month." And so you see, Sarah was comfortable with her fear, like an old shoe. It was somehow like a friend, a known quantity, something that was always there. And just like an old shoe, it might be ugly and tattered, but she had worn it for so long that it was the last thing she felt she could change.
Again, this is a true story. Sarah is real. And the fear of small places, the job, and the problem is real. You will be pleased to know that Sarah walked into her fears, and to this day she rides the subway train in joy and peace to her wonderful job. But there was a time when she doubted it could happen. She would say, "What? This psychological problem has always been here. How could it ever leave? This is just too much to ask." Sarah finally decided that the job was more important than her fear. And she found, to her amazement,
that her intent to avoid the claustrophobia was honored by God with almost immediate results. Just as her mind had a setup to create a fear of enclosed spaces, her mind also had the setup and ability to avoid it. And she took control of the situation and did exactly that. What a concept.
Story of the Two Farmers. Most of you are not farmers. In fact, in this country, they're becoming scarce. This story is definitely for you, however, and carries a terrific, loving message of earth changes and the new energy we are seeing taking place all around us.
There were once two good farmers. Both farmers each owned a crop that they were able to farm on their own without help from others. But it took all their time, and they worked hard to harvest it. Both farmers were godly humans, and they honored the land appropriately. This created a fine partnership with the earth, and they were rewarded with abundant crops each year and were able to provide for themselves and their families. Some of their harvest was used personally, and some was sold at market to provide sustenance and abundance for their families. They lived good lives. One day, an anointed human appeared in each of their fields, claiming to have a message from God. Both farmers were interested and listened intently to the message. The messenger told them that they were dearly loved, and that through their hard work, they had earned the power to increase their harvest tenfold. It was their gift, and they now had the power within them to do it. In order to activate the new power, all the farmers had to do was to purge the old crop that was growing in their fields. They had to plow it back into the land completely, leaving none of it standing. In addition, they were to search the roots for parasites or fungus and cast out any impurities they found. When they had done so, they were to reseed immediately. In anticipation of their power, the messenger told them that God was changing the seasons, bringing greater sun and rain when appropriate, and shielding them from drought, truly rearranging the components of agriculture as they knew it, to allow for their new gift's use. They would still be responsible for accomplishing the hard work of a farmer, but the new gift would eventually make the yield much larger. Now, it was in the time of year that the harvest of the old crop was almost at hand. Both farmers had tall crops that were ready to be cut and sold at market, thereby giving them their sustenance for the entire year to come, and to allow them to purchase the seeds for next season's crop. Both farmers were hesitant to destroy their current crop and lose their security for the subsequent season. After all, they thought, what would be the harm in harvesting now, then using the information of the messenger later? The current crop was almost ready, and reseeding at this time would do no good at this time of year, so their thinking went. Any farmer knew that seeds would not grow now. The first farmer consulted with his family about the message and asked them for advice. After thinking over what he had heard from the messenger, he and his family decided that God would never bring them harm, so it would be best to follow the message to the letter. Therefore, he destroyed his ripe harvest in the manner specified and totally plowed it back into the land. He examined it for all impurities, casting them out carefully, and then immediately reseeded his fields. The second farmer did not believe the messenger and prepared to harvest his crop as usual. Shortly thereafter, the rains came. This shocked both farmers greatly, for rain had never come at this time of year before. It watered the seeds of the first farmer's crop and deluged the standing crop of the second. Then came the wind, at a time wind had never blown before. The first farmer's crop was just starting to grow due to the rain, and so the wind could not take hold of it. What was left of the second farmer's waterlogged crop stood heavy and tall, and was easily ripped away by the strong winds. And so it was that the first farmer's crop grew to a quantity and height he had never imagined. And he rejoiced in his new power to create an abundant harvest, just as the messenger had predicted. The second farmer lost his old crop and awaited a time when he could align with the new seasons and again plant his seeds, feeling uncertain and anxious over the new, uncharted seasonal changes. Being godly men, the first farmer celebrated his abundance by giving of it to the second farmer. And the second farmer, understanding the ways of the earth, accepted the first farmer's offer without ego or remorse over his own decision. Both farmers and their families worked both of their lands until the second farmer again had the chance to plant his seeds in the new season.
The farmer is used here to clearly represent a human in marriage with the earth, toiling in harmony with nature to achieve life sustenance. In addition, these farmers specifically were independent, able to farm on their own without help from the others. So we have the setup of two humans walking the earth who depend on the planet for sustenance and who are totally responsible for everything around them. Does this scenario sound familiar? It's a strong metaphor for the way most of us live. The farmers represent those of us walking the earth right now. The next part of the setup relates to those of us who live in relative security. Cryon exposes this idea when he states how the farmers led generally happy lives and usually yielded abundant crops each year. This indicates the kind of life most of us have, where we work hard and somehow make it financially from year to year. Cryon also goes on to reveal that the parable takes place in a free economy, where some of their harvest was used personally and some was sold at market to provide sustenance and abundance for their families. These words are all important, for they place the story firmly within our free economic society. The greatest revelation, however, are the sentences, "One day an anointed human appeared in each of the fields, claiming to have a message from God. Both farmers were interested and listened intently to the message." This is an amazing clue as to whom Cryon is actually speaking about. What would happen with most folks if a fellow showed up telling them that they had a message from God? Most would throw the guy out and have a good laugh. Such is the culture we live in. But these farmers were different because they were interested and listened intently to the message. Note that they were not just passively interested, but they listened intently. Most of you hearing this are seeing where this is going. What Cryon means is that he is about to give us a parable about two humans living in the New Age who are enlightened. The parable goes on to describe how the messenger lets the farmers know that they have a change coming. But in order to take it, they have to do something different and seemingly illogical. It's something they have not done before, and it goes against what they have been taught works for agriculture. Look closely at what they were told and what it means. Number one, purge the old crop and get rid of all of your past ways of doing things. Number two, plow it under, bury your past ways so completely that they are truly gone. The third one, cast out the impurities and parasites as you plow it back under. Don't keep attachments around, including things in your life that you have always had riding along, but that you have intuitively known are wrong for you. The fourth one, reseed immediately. Start growing with the new energy and the new ways of things right now. And number five, the messenger then went on to let them know that the earth around them was going to change, allowing this new arrangement to be comfortable and to support them. As the story goes, one farmer has a lot of trouble with all of this, since his crop is ready to harvest, and he really doesn't believe everything he was told by the messenger. Cryon tells us that both farmers were hesitant to destroy a full crop, showing that it was even difficult for the one who finally did as he was advised. This means that what is being asked of us is difficult. It won't be easy for any of us to truly cast out the old way we do things and embrace the new. Even with vast rewards promised, like a tenfold harvest, it's hard, since we can't really see what is ahead. Still, I always wondered, as I thought about this parable, how a messenger from God could be ignored. Then I chuckled to myself when I remembered that in Sunday school I asked myself the same question when I first learned about Pharaoh hardening his heart time after time when Moses kept bringing big-time proof that it was bad news not to let those slaves go. Was Pharaoh stupid or what? Now Cryon is showing me the same hard streak in all of us. It's really difficult to change our ways and habits when they are so dear to us and we have depended on them for so long. In the parable, one farmer follows the advice, and the other does not. Shortly thereafter, both are shocked by the earth changes, rains and winds that had never been seen before at that time of the year. The earth changes are beneficial to the farmer's crop who had followed the messenger's advice, and indeed his newly seeded crop grows to record heights. The other farmer's crop is destroyed, even though it was healthy and tall when the messenger arrived. The admonition here is clear. The old ways will no longer work. The earth changes are going to make them fall as seeds on barren ground, and they will no longer grow. Even the most healthy and successful old energy methods are going to fall away. The ones that will be successful are new, often different, and represent uncharted waters. They are also the methods that will keep us filled with love, abundance, and positive results. Finally, the one with the abundance shares it with the one who did not listen. There is no judgment involved and no finger pointing. The second farmer, who obviously messed up, also does not feel too proud to receive from the one that did well. There is so much lurking in this simple message that it would take volumes to fully describe the wisdom for this new age. Both farmers took responsibility for what they had created, and they worked together in harmony and appropriateness to bring about a win-win situation for all. This parable was intended directly for the enlightened, the teachers and the workers. Amazing validations of the lesson presented here have come forward in many ways, showing that this parable is not to be taken lightly. It actually represents a scenario for the kind of change that is taking place on this planet as you hear these words. Take a moment to listen to it again. It's packed with a wonderful and powerful message.